Hello, my name's Charlie. I'm from Bishop FM, and I'm at Vesuvio with
Darren
and
Tom.
For those who don't know about Vesuvio, tell us about the place.
We're a wine shop and bar, essentially, in Darlington. What else would you say about us, Tom?
Started in 2011. Essentially, born from our passion for wine, really, and it's gone from there.
We became a restaurant about a year ago. Somehow acquired a 75-year-old tennis professional to cook for us, and that seems to work quite well.
So what type of food do you serve in the restaurant?
It's generally quite French-inspired. He spent quite a long time coaching tennis in Spain, where he seems to have picked up some cooking skills, so it's quite Spanish-influenced as well. I wouldn't call it tapas, but
eclectic European Mediterranean
food.
Yes. Fair enough. Now, you've just come back from a trip abroad tasting wine. Is that really more difficult than it sounds?
It's far, far, far more difficult than it sounds.
It's
treacherous. Well, if you can imagine tasting 400 wines in one day and having to spit every single one of them out and still being drunk at the end of it.
It's quite difficult to make realistic commercial decisions as well when you're
when you're on the 399th.
Yeah, and you've tasted the sort of 20th really heavy Argentinian red wine, and you're trying to evaluate the selling sort of potential of every wine that you taste, and while looking at the price and everything else, it is quite hard work, believe it or not.
So, what are your top tips for tasting wine properly?
Take your time for a start. It's always worthwhile decanting a wine if you can. The glass shape as well, if you can have a tulip shaped glass, it works much better. Swirl it round, mm-hmm. Have a look at it first.
What's it meant to look like?
Usually if it's cloudier, if it has lumps in it, I wouldn't advise drinking it.
That's mulled wine, isn't it?
With the exception of mulled wine, right, and sangria. Okay. Swirl it around in the glass because you're going to aerate it. You'll release more aromas by doing that. Sip a little bit of it. Pull a bit of air across it over mm-hmm. your tongue.
And try and make sure the wine basically touches as many parts of the inside of your mouth as possible is a good rule of thumb, really.
It's like swirl it round in your mouth. Like mouthwash.
Yeah, but red wines in particular do benefit massively from being sort of open for as long as you can, really, up to sort of... Well, they did an experiment for a Decanter magazine, which is quite a big, famous sort of wine magazine. Where they tasted wine through various stages after having opened it and poured it into a jug. And they found that the optimum time for leaving a wine open is 9 hours. Mm-hmm. But obviously that's not very practical for a lot of people when they get home from work. So if you leave it for 20 minutes, it generally changes quite a lot. If you pour it into your glass, leave it for 10 minutes, it's generally a better drink when you come back to it.
I've noticed some wines taste totally different from when they're eaten with food to when you just drink them by themselves. How does that work?
There tends to be certain things in each meal that will dominate the flavour of the meal. There's another anecdote. I did a tasting with a South African guy once, and he made some beef bourguignon, and he made exactly the same dish but put cardamom pods in the dish. Uh-huh. And then the normal beef bourguignon was great with the red, but the one with cardamom pods in was horrific with red wine. It worked really well with the white wine, even though he cooked it in red wine. The cardamom just threw it all over.
That's really strange. So does cardamom go with white wine more?
Much better. Yeah. Things like salt levels in a wine as well. If you're eating something quite salty, like blue cheese or something like that, it can really react with the tannins in red wine as well, which makes it appear quite grippy and sort of sticks to your mouth more. There's so many different permutations of.
I think cheese is one of the biggest conundrums with wines. I mean, a lot of people associate wine with cheese, but we find that cheese is one of the hardest things to match with wine. A lot of people like eating sort of quite strong cheese. Say you have a mature cheddar, a lot of people might drink that with a heavy Cabernet Sauvignon or Shiraz, something like that, and it really does not work. Most cheese goes well with something with a bit of sweetness in it, really. Port and cheese is a very good match. Anything with a bit of sweetness, because cheese generally that people like to eat does have that sweetness and a really strong flavour, and it can clash quite badly with a lot of wine, particularly heavy, tannic, dry red wines, because it just tends to make it seem dry and more dry and more tannic.
Yeah.
And the fruit kind of disappears because of the sweetness of the cheese. I mean, that's the biggest challenge, really, I think, matching cheese and wine, because it's just one of those things. I mean, cheese and wine seem to go well together, but generally they don't.
I think as a rule of thumb with anything, you always look for the predominant flavour in the dish.
Mm-hmm.
And try and balance it. One of the most interesting ones being cod with black pudding.
I mean, fish is quite a simple thing to match, because obviously fish usually has quite a delicate flavour, particularly white fish or salmon or something like that. It goes well with various types of white wine, but quite rarely with red wine. If you have a salmon or even a sort of quite a welcome, sort of rich sea bass kind of fish, that can go well with a light red wine like Pinot Noir or possibly a Beaujolais with sort of very little tannin. It feels like a white wine in your mouth, but...
That leads me to my next question. It's Easter soon, so what would you recommend for us to drink with our Good Friday fish and chips?
I thought you were going to say chocolate, though.
That's
all right, okay.
Sparkling wine.
Sparkling wine with fish and chips.
There's champagne.
There's a big movement at the minute, particularly bars in London, actually. I've seen a couple that specialise in champagne and fish and chips.
Right.
I mean, fish and chips, obviously, is quite a greasy food.
Mm-hmm.
You want something quite acidic and quite crisp to sort of cut through that grease. And champagne works really well. I mean, not just champagne, I mean, any good sparkling wine. We had a guy from Italy over a couple of times, and he did a tasting. It's from a region called Franciacorta, and they make champagne style sparkling wines, but in a hotter place than champagne, so it's generally a little bit fruitier.
Yeah.
And we gave everybody fish and chips that were at the tasting, and they had it with this Franciacorta, and it worked absolutely amazingly well.
He thought it was the most amazing thing he'd ever
found. Franciacorta fish and chips!
Franciacorta fish and chips, which he says to us every time.
Every time. Okay, so on Easter Sunday, most people have lamb roast dinner. What would you suggest with that?
Pinot Noir.
Right.
Or Cabernet Sauvignon.
Or Rioja.
We argue about this quite a lot.
I can see a little argument starting already.
Cabernet Sauvignon works quite well if you want a fuller bodied wine, because it does tend to have quite herbaceous characteristics. One of them's rosemary and eucalyptus and things like that. If you like a full bodied wine, go for a Cabernet Sauvignon.
I think nothing too fruity, really, because lamb is quite herbaceous, often cooked with rosemary and things like that. And you often get the similar type of flavours in a good Pinot Noir, a good sort of a good aged Rioja, or a Cabernet Sauvignon, like Tom says. I can't be bothered to argue with you.
Okay, and of course, what about with our Easter eggs? What wine would you recommend with that?
Oh, we've done quite a lot of experimentation with wine and chocolate recently. I mean, they have released a range of chocolate that does go well, that is supposed to match sort of various types of wine. It would seem like a complete no-no to drink red wine with chocolate, but I do find that it quite often does work.
You get something big and soft.
Yeah.
With a little bit of kind of...
A rich sort of New World Merlot or something like that. Generally, would go quite well with an Easter egg, like milk chocolate kind of thing. I mean, you could go for something like a dessert wine that has more sort of marmalade, orangey flavour. It depends what you like, really. It's about experimentation, I think, more than anything else. I mean... We had some chocolate in recently. It's a sort of quite a soft, sweet milk chocolate, but with hazelnuts. And that tends to go well with soft red wines like Merlot.
Mm-hmm.
Easter eggs are a little bit different, but... The best wine that I've had with Easter eggs is an Aliatico, which is a dessert wine from Tuscany. It's a red dessert wine. Port would go very well with chocolate.
So, do you both have a favourite wine?
I quite often get asked this, and it tends to change day to day. I mean, at the minute we're particularly getting into Romanian wine, and we all are, to be honest. We sort of discovered a winery in Romania that were incredibly cheap, but they're so good for the money. We're finding quite a lot of wine from Eastern Europe at the minute. It can be really interesting. Excellent sort of bang for buck.
Some quite interesting local varieties as well from Romania. Feti Escanegra that we've got on by the glass at the minute. Really different. It's unlike anything else that I've ever tried as well. It's, yeah. Eastern European wines. That's what we're into at the minute.
Yes. We do plan to do a Soviet wine tasting quite soon to sort of explore Eastern Europe and everything else. That's my little project anyway.
So how did you both become wine experts then?
Well, funnily enough, I mean, I went to university, came back, and I was living with my parents and not paying any rent or anything like that. So I tended to wander into Oddbins, where Tom was managing, just around the corner from here. And
that's where we started our beautiful relationship.
Somebody, it might have been, I can't remember now, persuaded me to spend, I think it was £8 on a bottle of wine, which at the time I thought was absolutely just absurd, ridiculous. Who would spend £8 on a bottle of wine? And it kind of went from there, really. I tried that and then sort of tried a few others, bought a few books, and then I've worked for a couple of wine companies. Tom had a slightly different introduction into it, I think. But
I started working for an Italian guy and in the kitchen, and he seemed to think that I wanted to drink wine and used to just thrust things in my hand. And, today... which, yeah, that's kind of how I got into it, really. He's still quite a good friend today, really. Yeah.
Does he still make you drink wine like that?
Anything that he wants
to
try. No,
we tend to make him drink wine nowadays.
Yeah, it's role reversal now. I ended up working for Oddbins after I'd worked in that restaurant for about 10 years. It's one of those bugs that just kind of captures you, I think. Endlessly explorable.
So how can the general public learn more about booze?
Drink more of it. I mean, it depends how much you're sort of interested in what you're drinking, really. A lot of people are quite happy to go to a supermarket and pick up a bottle that says Shiraz or Pinot Grigio or Sauvignon Blanc on the label, and they know that there's a flavour in there that they'll enjoy. If you'd like to know the sort of where it's from, I mean, to me, wine isn't necessarily a drink. It's the expression of a place and a time, which is why I find it so fascinating. I think that you can walk into a wine shop and you can find out the provenance of a wine, where it's from, how it was made, who made it, how it differs to other wine, and why it tastes different because of that. I mean, there's so many different permutations, as Tom says, of how wine can be made and how different it can taste. And it's kind of an emotional product, really, the kind of emotions it can give you.
Yeah.
Which is why I don't think I'll ever get bored of it. Because, I mean, when I started drinking wine, I'm 31 now, maybe 8 years ago, sort of seriously started thinking about what I was drinking. I wouldn't ever have dreamt of sort of tasting anything from Eastern Europe or from England or but I mean, fashions change very quickly and technologies change very quickly and trends change very quickly. I mean, a lot of it can be political as well. I mean, a lot of the wine from the old Soviet Union, it was all state owned and very bland and very generic, but now there's a lot of sort of innovative winemakers there, and it's changed quite a lot even from the short time that I've been sort of thinking and drinking wine.
I think if you are kind of serious about getting into wine and learning about it, the best thing to do is just get a little book and write notes in it. Explore grape varieties that you're interested in, but try them from a lot of different countries, and you'll find that the style varies a lot.
So does the country and the grape vary in tastes?
Yeah,
same grape,
yeah.
From a different country.
I mean, if you had, say, Syrah from Northern Rome and compare it with Shiraz from McLaren Vale in Australia, they'd be completely different. They will share certain characteristics, but that's... If you can try lots of different single grape varieties from around the world as a starting point, you'll gain that kind of knowledge of that grape on a whole, you know, so... Syrah or Shiraz, which is the same grape variety, will have a slight amount of pepper. It's usually kind of black berry, really.
I mean, some of the Rhone Syrahs that we have, they are kind of almost like raspberry and white pepper. It's quite a lean, sort of feminine style of wine, really. And then like you said, you'll try a Shiraz from a hot place in Australia like McLaren Vale, and it'll just be huge chocolate and bacon kind of flavours, and it'll might sound a bit strange, but
I do like chocolate bacon.
Like. Sauvignon Blanc's another good one as well. I mean, Marlborough Sauvignon Blanc seems to become a brand nowadays, and it tends to deliver quite pungent, really fruity wines.
Really, you think about something like the Sancerre, which is kind of the classic French region. It's a completely different drink, really.
Exactly the same grape that it's made from, but two things, really. I mean, the culture of the area and how to make the wine and the climate. You try a Sancerre and it's quite flinty, and it tastes of rocks and green pepper almost, rather than sort of really pungent fruit, and it can be quite soft. But Marlborough Sauvignon Blancs tend to be just in your face all the time, and that's why they've become really popular. Yeah. I think so. Yeah, it can. I mean, that's just two examples of two grapes, but it works with every single grape in the world. Really, it'll taste completely different as to where it's from.
And then you start trying blends as well, which is the true mastery of winemaking.
Yeah. When your palate is tuned in and you have a break from wine, is it difficult to get tuned into the fine details of wine again if you've had a long break from not drinking?
No.
I think drinking too much is probably the worst way to destroy your palate, to be honest.
I mean, you get that from wine tastings when you're on your sort of 30th wine, like I said before, you just can't taste anything. Your mouth is covered with just red fluff from the wine. Depending on what wine you're drinking, obviously, but
some quite horrific coloured teeth and tongues after tasting.
Yeah.
Bright pink lips.
Blue teeth.
I wouldn't say it's hard to get back to it if you have I wouldn't really know what it's like to have a break, though, to be honest. I'm probably the wrong person to ask it.
Okay, here's my stupid question of the day.
Go on.
All wine is made from grapes. Where do all the different tastes and flavours come from?
That's very
one of the sorceries of wine, I think. You can taste a grape juice made from, or you can taste grapes off the vine, and they're generally quite sour and bitter. And you, not many sort of grapes off the vine that I've had that go into make wine taste very nice.
So they're not like the grapes you get in shops.
No.
They're not particularly sweet.
No, I mean,
they tend
to have quite thick skins, very acidic, and it's hard to really understand how that translates into the wine, but it's some kind of chemistry that goes on in the fermentation process that changes the flavours and the chemicals in the wine.
There's so many different variables, like we were saying before. There's the soil that they're grown in, the climate, the grape variety. And whether you choose to blend the grape varieties together. I mean, all winemakers blend different vats together to create their overall wine anyway.
Yeah.
So a lot of it's to do with the vineyard, but then a lot of it's to do with the actual winemaker themselves. They choose to create a certain style of wine. Again, infinite variables, to be honest.
I remember driving across down a road in Spain once, and it was not particularly famous wine-grown region, but there was a load of... there were Monastrell grapes, so really blue, dark grapes. Just looking at them as we were driving down the road, I'm going to have to stop here and pick one just to try it. I was really thirsty, I just wanted something. And just pulled over and pulled these grapes off this vine at the side of the road. It was the most disgusting thing I've ever put in my mouth. It was just bitter and
horrible.
Pinching grapes, yeah. It's shocking.
I think it must have been for the tourists, the outer row when they were driving past.
Wax.
I'm not going to tell you where that was in case the Spanish the authorities come to find me.
So you like the East European wines at the moment. Which country do you think produces the best wines?
Very much depends on what you like.
I mean, traditionally French wine is seen as the pinnacle of how wine can be. I don't really find that.
I think in terms of an individual country, Italy's probably got the most variation.
Yeah, I mean, if you look back at the history of wine, it can give you a clue sometimes. Wine was taken to France by the Greeks and the Romans, so there weren't any vines in France before sort of the Roman invasion, really. I mean, the birthplace of wine is Georgia. I think there's 8,000 years ago the evidence comes from of winemaking, the earliest winemaking that they've ever found. So it's difficult. Like I said, it changes quite a lot. I mean, the Bordeaux wine trade, which is kind of seen as the pinnacle of the wine trade now in money-wise anyway, that was really created by in a large part by the British trade. The port trade as well, I mean, a lot of it was created by the British, so it depends geographically where it is. It was next to the sea and it was easy to get to Britain, so that kind of grew up as a wine trade. I mean, personally for me, I'm a big fan of Italy because it's got huge variation in every single part of it, and every single part of Italy is a wine region, and it's just ingrained in their culture, and I think that helps a lot when it comes to how you make wine, really. So I would say Italy for me, but obviously I can't say that categorically because there's a lot of opinions out there.
I think it's always interesting when you go somewhere that each individual region in Italy has its own little microcosm of food and wine that's associated with it. And they're all very different and they all cling very vehemently to their ideas of exactly what you should be having.
I was almost thrown out of a bar in Friuli, which is sort of the very northeast of Italy, for asking for a glass of Prosecco, which is from 50 miles down the road. Absolutely unthinkable to serve Prosecco.
Absolutely.
Because it's not from there. I had to have a sparkling Robbola Gialla instead. It's quite an obscure wine from their particular town. That's one of the reasons I like Italy, and particularly its wine, anyway.
So what do you think of UK producers of wine?
It can be fantastic. I mean, it's very limited, I think. The climate is quite marginal and cool for making wine. The sparkling wine can be absolutely outstanding. Some of it's as good as any champagne.
I think some of the best sparkling wines that we've had since we opened have been English.
Oh, definitely.
But the also charging the prices of champagne already as well.
So they should.
Well, yeah, exactly.
But you find a large, there's a lot of champenois, that French from Champagne, buying huge tracts of land across southern England now because it's kind of the new sort of fashionable place to make sparkling wine.
That chalky soil that they have in Champagne that they claim to be the best type of soil to grow grapes on dips below the channel and pops back up in kind of Kent, Sussex kind of areas.
Well, it's
the same kind of chalky soil. So that's one of the main reasons.
I think the climate in sort of a lot of southern England now is exactly the same as it was in the 70s in Champagne. So they're making essentially the same wine that the Champenois made in the 70s.
We've had some pretty funky reds, right?
Yeah, the reds have got some way to go. One wine I had from, I won't name the estate.
From somewhere.
From somewhere. It tasted like, the only way I could describe it was the juice out of a can of Heinz baked beans. That's probably the best red that I've had from England.
That's really selling it to me, thank you. I must go out and find some.
There's a fantastic winery actually near here. It's Wetherby, just off the M1. It's called Leventhorpe. He makes a
Junction 46 on the M1, not Junction 46 on the A1.
Right.
Made that mistake when we went to visit him the first time.
he's a good winemaker, and he makes a really good sparkling wine. A couple of good whites as well. I think that's the most northerly commercial vineyard in Europe.
Yeah.
Or was at one point.
That's pretty close to us, though. That's pretty good. Yeah.
It's worth a visit, anyway. It's worth going there.
Can you actually go there and try the wine?
Yeah. He's basically got a big shed that he makes his wine in, and he has a little tasting counter, and he's always playing around with something, and he's quite happy to talk you through it and let you taste it. So it's well worth a visit down
Ring
there.
Ring him up and book first, then.
Yeah. Just going on hordes of people going there.
He gets a little bit shirty.
So apart from wine, what do you both enjoy drinking?
Well, we're quite big fans of gin and tonics. We do quite a big range of gin here. We quite often play around with various twists with it and ways of making it. That's one of my things. I mean, I'm not a huge fan of beer in general. I can't drink a lot of it. I'm not a huge fan of whiskey.
Yeah.
Of course, you just look at it.
Yeah, there's that same kind of variation in beers as there is in wine, really. Not quite as much.
You can have another
Argument. I tend to do a lot of the beer buying. And every time new stuff comes in, we all leap about like excitable chimps when they come in. I think it's the fact that you can have a small amount because they're in smaller
that
bottles.
That does help.
Yeah.
It's less alcoholic as well.
But I definitely agree with Darren. I used to drink a lot of beer, and I can't now. I think about a pint and I'm full. It's more space if you have.
But you're quite into whiskey as well, which I've never really got. I'll allow myself one spirit vice at the minute, and that's gin, so I'll probably change to something else.
It was rum when we first opened.
Yeah, yeah.
I'll ask you when very much into rum.
Yeah, do that, yeah. It'll be completely different what we serve. Yeah.
So now back to Vesuvio. What's planned for the next few months?
We've got, talking about cheese and wine earlier on, we've got a cheese, we've kind of called it a cheese workshop on Sunday afternoon, which we're going to...
We're going to build a large building out of cheese.
Yeah.
That's what we're doing.
Right.
Well, not really. So we're going to match various, not just wine, but alcoholic drinks with cheese to kind of illustrate that it doesn't have to be wine to go with cheese, really. There's a lot of... Particularly like the Belgian beers are really malty, something sweet Belgian beers go really well with cheese. We'll have a few tastings coming up. Like I said, I'm very keen to do a Soviet tasting, so I think that is the emerging region of the world at the minute in wine terms.
Do you hold events here then?
Generally about once a month. Mm-hmm. Some of them can just be quite fun, like the 80s tasting that we have. Where we kind of just sort of pick some wines that were popular in the 80s and...
And force people to drink.
Yeah.
Take them at gunpoint, pretty much.
How do you know that?
But yeah, we're always planning to do stuff. The best way to find out is to follow us on Facebook or Twitter, because we tend to funnel everything.
Tend to be quite impulsive and just put things on there, and then we're kind of obliged to do them then. So,
once you've said it, you can't go back, can you?
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And if anybody needs any more information, just to go on there to Vesuvio on Facebook.
Facebook or Twitter, At Vesuvio Wine on Twitter and Vesuvio on Facebook.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Brilliant.